compels me.
What the fuck's the matter with these cunts? What's the matter with them? That must be on some fucking mega ego trip, these guys.
We got horses and bloody ducks.
The whole part of being a rock star is being a rock star. And what's the rock stars do? You get a limo, you get a Learjet, you got people running around licking your ass.
I get nicknamed Nibby.
I looked at Bill Ward and he had this big long beard. And I said, you look like a pen nit. A stone.
Hello, I'm Ozzy.
Very strange, and Geezer in particular had all sorts of weird dreams and weird thoughts, and it might have been the acid, I don't know.
This is Sabbath Bloody Podcast, a sabography for the masses. Never Say Die, the season finale today. The often forgotten classic Sabbath record. That's right, fucker, they're all still classic albums at this point. I don't care what you say. We are closing out the first chapter here, Supernauts. This is truly the end of the beginning in the sabography that we've been creating together here. I mean, we still have Reunion and 13 with Ozzy, so don't get too emo just yet, but Never Say Die is the last of Sabbath Prime, the band of brothers that we've all come to love. And it's not a straightforward parting of ways by any means, so this show might have a strange flow to it today. I'll try to squeak in all the regular segments as we roll through another album offering from the Sabbath, but the first 8 albums complete, that's a big chunk of a catalog. A lot of bands don't even get 3 albums out before they fucking break up or turn into something else. I got my pint here today because we really got to put the Sabbath Bloody Podcast stamp on this era. It deserves a proper send-off. So cheers, Supernauts, and thanks for coming this far with me. It's been fun. I want to take some time away from the show after tonight, my own little summer vacay. I'm enjoying doing this dive into Sabbath, but fuck, man, I need a break. I need to reboot and refresh for the Dio era forward, which will happen eventually. I just want to make sure I evolve the show's structure too, you know? Just like Sabbath evolves from album to album. Maybe the next ones will be really proggy. As hinted at last episode, aside from the fact that I like most of Technical Ecstasy, it was a big flop for the boys commercially. A big part of this was less support from manager Don Arden. He was more interested in trying to help ELO make it over in America at the time. They still managed to get a solid tour together for it, though. Starting in the States, this time in the Southwest, they bring along Boston as the opener. It's more than a feeling. It's basically the two of them through October and November. Hart jumps on for a couple of gigs, too, actually, and Seeger. It's all arena shows. So they close out 76 with a string of, I guess, 8 or so gigs here with the Nuge. Now, I've been on a big Ted Nugent kick lately. He is so fucking underrated. And I know a lot of people can't separate the man from the music. And yeah, he's a total shithead. But damn, that Detroit dirty rock that he's bringing is fucking kick ass. I guess that's why I'd like Never Say Die. It's really Sabbath leaning heavy on that dirty sound. So then they have some cancellations in 76 that lead to a couple of hangover gigs in early 77. That seems to be commonplace for them in the mid to late 1970s tours. They're not as dedicated in the way that they don't control their partying. It's most likely due to the mass consumption of drugs and they're constantly having to do makeup shows because Ozzy's fucking sleeping in and shit or going to the wrong hotel room. But March sees them make their way back home across the pond where they play a long string of UK gigs, including 4 nights at the Hammersmith Odeon with a great opener, band called Nuts. That's right, Nuts with a Z. That gets us up to the point when the boys decide to get off the road and start working on material for their next album. Let me have a swig here. Fuck, it's bloody hot in Ireland these days. We've been getting fucking heat waves every other week, it seems. Speaking of summer, over the summer in 1977, Sabbath set up camp again in L.A., and this is where the shit gets real sour. Ozzy's becoming very fed up with Tony's control over the band. And he's also whacked out of his mind from the excess drug use and alcohol. Like, this is the height of self-destructive Ozzy Osbourne. On top of all that bullshit, his father Jack dies while they're in the studio and throws Ozzy into a deep depression. And that eventually leads to him announcing that he's quitting Black Sabbath. He's had it with Prog Sabbath. He wants to go solo. So Tony's quick to say, fuck Ozzy. Let's get someone else to lay vocals down. And let's do it now. the other two, Gies and Nibby, they've went on record as saying they just wanted to wait for Ozzy to get his shit in line. But Tony had enough of all that. He took the opportunity to just give him the boot, kind of. He even lined up some gigs to really put the pressure on getting a new singer and powering through. Tony called up his old Brummy pal, Mr. David Walker of the band Savory Brown. Now, Walker was over in the States with his band in San Francisco, but Tony got a hold of him from England and said, hey, you want to come back here, join Sabbath? Walker, of course, said, fuck yeah, I'll be in Sabbath. When's my plane leave? And for the next 3 weeks, Walker wrote all kinds of lyrics to the music that Sabbath had been working on with Ozzy in the studio. To set things off, they were slotted to appear in the BBC Midlands TV program called Look Here, as in look here, as in here with your fucking ears. Clever title. Forming what turned out to be an early draft of a fucking great song that we'll get to from Never Say Die. A track called Junior's Eyes. It was a dark few months for Sabbath, though, with Tony wanting to press on and the others missing Ozzy. During this time period, Ozzy even attempts to put together his own band, as I mentioned. He even has a name picked out and t-shirts made for a solo project called Blizzard of Oz. That, of course, becomes his first proper studio album in the 80s, with Randy Rhoads, as you surely know. But at first, back in 78, he recruited Necromandus guitarist Barry Dunnery, bass player Dennis McCarthen, and drummer Frank Hall, and they recorded a few demos for a proposed album. Now, these demos haven't surfaced, unfortunately, so I can't play them for you today. And later in that same year, Ozzy makes another attempt at a solo project with a different lineup, recruiting Dirty Tricks guitarist John Fraser Breeny, bassist Terry Horbury, and drummer Andy Brin. Again, nothing gets off the ground there. I'm thinking Ozzy was to blame for these not working and nothing amounting to it. Like I said, he was fucking whacked out at this point, like even high by Ozzy standards. But let's slip back to the main camp here. The other three guys are pressing on. And here's a blurb from Nibby on those days with Walker in retrospect. And this really segues to Ozzy's eventual return to Sabbath. So Nibby says, I felt crap at the time while Oz was away. If I sound vague, I am vague and very foggy about back then. We all liked Dave Walker as a mate, so to speak. We got to know him when he fronted Savory Brown, and earlier when Dave played in the Redcaps, an early Birmingham band from the 60s. I liked Dave a lot, and I thought he had a great voice. When it came time to choose another singer, all kinds of names came up, but Dave's stayed. So Dave flew in from Frisco to Field Farm, where we got on with rehearsals. Oddly enough, it was me who let Dave know that things weren't working out. I volunteered again, just as he did with Ozzy, apparently. I felt awkward and uncomfortable telling Dave this, as I liked him very much as a person. So Walker became the first of many hired guns in the Sabbath camp, left in the wake of the mighty Black Sabbath machine with the two Boca Toke blokes and Jim Simpson. A month after his departure, Ozzy was back in Sabbath, and they went over to Toronto to make a new album. In the end, cash was key, as it continued to be with Ozzy and Sabbath. And Don Arden wanted Sabbath with Ozzy. That's what he wanted to sell. So that's what happened. As for Walker, he was given his marching orders, but at least he felt like his time would be compensated by having so many writing credits on the new album, right? But no. Don Arden and Ozzy nixed that. Ozzy refused to sing anything written during his hiatus, and Geezer had to sit down and rewrite the songs with Ozzy in mind. Not necessarily a bad thing, as I feel the lyrics are a lot more in the moment on Never Say Die. They're very reflective of the whole band's vibe at the time, and that's fucking great. I think Walker was more of like a generic bluesy rock approach to things. The lyrics that ultimately make it on Never Say Die are great.
Power of the riff compels me.
Won't you listen?
Boys are back in town. Boys are back in town. Turning into Lizzy Bloody Podcast all of a sudden. The feel of this track here, the lead off, very Thin Lizzy. Some great upbeat, dirty fucking rock and roll party, baby. I love that about Never Say Die. It's just a fantastic pop rock album. I know no one wants to hear a pop rock album from their Black Sabbath, except me. I do. This is fucking some dirty Detroit Rock City style shit. Love it. Although the doom is completely kind of purged at this point, it makes sense, man. They did like, what, 6 albums kind of in that vein? Give them a break. They got to bring some more flavor into it. These guys are getting fucking laid now too, so this track especially, such a great one for the radio. I know a lot of you super nuts are probably fucking cringing right now. Radio? Are you insane, radio? But Sabbath are far beyond that stupid fuck the radio scene that would arise with the thrash metal and the likes of that. I will defend Never Say Die as a great classic rock album. When you take into account how fucked up they were too as a band to generate the catchy songs that are on here, like fucking Junior's Eyes is way up there for me. Shockwave is amazing too. Johnny Blade even. This is fucking classic, man. I love these tracks. The title track was the perfect choice for the opener too. It kind of declares what it is. This big poppy arena rock at its best. But also, there's a very interesting B-side to this album, too. So let's get into it some more. Let's just go to the next track. A real hot mess of a song that follows up that killer lead track. Johnny Blade. The riff by itself here makes it sound kind of more heavy than it actually is, I will say. It's kind of a fucking Moog massacre to open this up. Like the keys really driving home the fucking digital sound. Sabbath has keys now. Fucking eat it. But it goes and it picks up and it's a catchy fucking little number. First half of the song, yeah, it's a little weak, I know. But the real good shit comes in the later half, though, around the 2.5 minute mark. That part is fucking so good. Let's see if Ben plays a riff here. So badass that it even gets the last Bauer shout out of the season here. The last power of the riff from the 70s Sabbath.
Power of the riff compels me.
Oh, yeah. And the rest of the track just fucking slams, too. I love Johnny Blade. Ozzy channeling Ziggy Stardust on his delivery with Johnny the Spider. It's just the lyrics that kind of stink on this one. Geezer has definitely lost his edge by this point. Something about Greaser Fox pulling switchblades and shit. There's a tour story that kind of ties into Johnny Blade. Not directly, but it does involve a switchblade. And well, it's kind of another Sabbath tale that's always out there. There's this alleged story that Geezer pulled a switchblade on Malcolm Young of AC/DC at a festival around this tour. Here's how Geezer recounts the story here in an interview with Classic Rock magazine in 2016. He says, "I've always had flick knives when I was growing up. because everyone goes around stabbing each other in Austin. Flick knives were banned in England, but when I was playing in Switzerland, I bought one. I was just flicking it when Malcolm Young came up to me and started slagging Sabbath. We were having a drink together and I was just playing around with the knife. I was really excited to get one again. I was having a drink, flicking my knife, like you do, and he came over and said, "You must think you're big having a flick knife." I said, "What are you talking about?" And that was it. Nobody got hurt. So maybe Geezer's Johnny Blade then. Anyway, the cool part of that is that AC/DC and fucking Black Sabbath were hanging out and drinking, right? So it's worth mentioning. Johnny Blade is half good of a song. Not as strong as the opener, but that's okay. We're still loving this album, right, guys? I'm going to get you into Never Say Die by the end of this fucking episode. That's my mission tonight. And shit, the next song, if this one doesn't pull you in, then fuck, all hope is lost for you, friend. Junior's Eyes. This was a reworking of a track that the band wrote during the short-lived David Walker period, when Ozzy went AWOL, and it's a fucking phenomenal song. Might not sound like much off the top, but the song fucking explodes in the choruses. Maybe the best chorus lift in Sabbath history. That's right, I'm fucking high on this track, man. Just go listen to it. And here, listen to the lift to the chorus. Just the guitar track, you can feel it. And Nibby just opens up on the LP. God damn, just goosebumps. Power of the riff compels me on this one as well, but we've already given it to Johnny Blade. Lyrically, this one's powerful too. It's about Ozzy losing his father to cancer while they were in the studio. When Ozzy finally reconvened with his bandmates and he tracked this one, Junior's Eyes cannot be denied. It's an all-time classic Sabbath track. All right, so let's keep moving though. I'll bring up the next track, which is also fucking amazing. So, in my opinion, we're already fucking 3 for 3 so far. And then we get on to the hard road. Okay, so just seeing the title alone, you might have written this off as a typical generic rock song, a hard road, right? Also, given the straight-ahead feel that Bill Ward delivers on here with a beat, you could read it as either a take on AC/DC's Long Way to the Top if you want to rock and roll, or some Styx song or something like that. But put it into context of where the Sabs were at that point and what they were going through with Ozzy. And the lyrics are actually more vague. I mean, it's not your Bon Jovi, like, "I loaded 6-string on my back," like those literal fucking rock life things. "I rocked all their faces," or whatever. "I rocked a lot of girls." It's none of that. It's a little more open to be attributed to life in general. Like, it's kind of just take care of yourself first, solve your own problems, and then, if the earth permits you to, help some other people too. Which is a lot more of an interesting statement than "it's hard to be out on the road, rocking and waking up with different girls every morning." That Bret Michaels, humble brag lyric shit that we get hammered with in the 80s. And musically, the song is fucking huge. I love Don Airey's keys on here. Very John Lord-like at times. His parts are really organic, and the song drones. It moves in waves with his keys. It's super rad. Tony, Geezer, and Nibby, they have an outstanding kind of chugging riff that perfectly illustrates that idea of like an endless road. On to the next one. Even better, in my opinion. Are there any bad songs on this record, Rye? I know. Say something negative about this album. We're supposed to hate it. But no, the magic of that first side carries on to the B-side with a fucking great Shockwave, absolutely underrated track. This might be the most underrated Sabbath's goddamn catalog, in my opinion anyway, of what I've heard. Shockwave, or Shockwaves, as Ozzy introduces it live on a few occasions that they play it. It's a great one live, too. And the vocals are great, too, especially in, like, the big fade-out. They have this, like, BGVs. On this whole album, there's a lot of great BGVs. That, you know, it's no Queen or anything, but it's cool that all the guys are kind of getting involved in the vocal process and taking everything to that stadium level. Shockwave is another great fucking stadium rocker. So after Shockwave, though, we get into more of an experimental offering for the album. It's a little hit and miss, this one, too, for me. Some of the flavors I don't really dig, but it's cool that they're trying it, and this is the right slot to be doing in a spot like that, right before the end. Midway through the B-side, that's when I'm ready to accept some kind of different flavors. So they drop Air Dance in. And Air Dance could really grow on me. Like, I do like parts of it, but there's kind of like a jazzy flavor, a little too Santana-y for my taste. And it carries on a little too long with the noodling and all that. I know, I need to fucking loosen up, man. Let the air dance in. I'll work on it. I'll give it a few more spins. But let's just push ahead now, because over to you. Very garagey tone coming back into the track here. This one's a lot like A Hard Road and Johnny Blade, actually. That riff kind of sounds like the Strokes or some shit, like a total garage band revival. Or I guess the Strokes sound like this, because this is the fucking 70s, man. This is when garage rock was big. A palate cleanser after Air Dance for me. All those piano flourishes and Spanish guitar that were in Air Dance. I need something that rocks a little bit more. But Over to You still has some experimental kind of parts in the bridge that kind of calls back to that piano flavor. Don Airey still puts a stamp down, but it's all done better here. It's more mixed in. Like I said, of Wakeman, Jez, and Airey, I lean more towards Don Airey's approach to the keys. Also, there's a big moment sequentially on the album here. So even though this track isn't that memorable song-wise, this is actually Ozzy Osbourne's last vocal cut in the 1970s, at least sequentially. I don't know if he recorded it last or anything like that, but so it's like, over to you. I'm out of here. Where's Dio? Not yet. There's still two more tracks to go on the album, but Ozzy fades out at this point. Single tear, Supernauts. I'm crying in my goddamn beer over here. I'll be honest with you guys. I fucking love the Ozzy Twilight Era songs. There's something very comforting about the tone. Like, it's like they know what's coming to an end, and like, I guess I'm putting it into the context of knowing that they get back together and all that shit, but Ozzy really comes into his voice after Volume 4, and then he just keeps climbing and climbing through Sabotage and fucking... There's a little bit of a misstep on Technical Ecstasy, but I don't think he's that into that whole point when he's really into doing his own thing, getting away from Sabbath, and he kind of gets pulled back in. But I never say die. It's like he gets pulled back in, but he knows, like, this is the end. I'm just going to put it out there. I'm just going to fucking have fun with this. So all you paranoid purists who check out after Master of Reality, go in expecting something fresh from this album, and you might find something that you enjoy. This really encapsulates the journey that Ozzy and the lads had taken this far. So let's break here for a moment of silence to say goodbye to Ozzy. Goodbye to romance. By silence, I mean, let's listen to me drink some stout. We still have two more tracks to get to, but Ozzy's done at this point. So moving on to Bill Ward fronted Sabbath here. First up, we get this big band instrumental number, which leads us into a very cool closer with Bill Ward actually grabbing the mic. But I don't have any riffs or anything to play for breakout here. But on this one even, the drums really kind of lead it. So yeah, Bill Ward fans rejoice because his time to shine has come at the end of Never Say Die. I love how there's this big tone shift. Breakout is this big fucking brass number done with their old collaborator, Mr. Will Malone. And Will, if you remember, was behind the strings on Snowblind back in the good old days. And so that he's kind of renewing his Sabs alumni card here. Unfortunately, I don't have any recordings that I can use to illustrate this track's real power, but it's a big stompy one. It's worth checking out. All kinds of crazy fucking saxophone in there and Bill, like I said, is just leading the charge with his beat. It's fucking lovely stuff. And then we get into Swingin' the Chain. Does Ben play that riff? Ah, yes, he does. Cool, because this is a fucking badass riff. Check it out. It's against my uniform. I love this track, and Bill Ward's vocals here again. I wish that Nibby did a track on every album, because he has this killer voice. It reminds me of one of my favorites, Neil Fallon from Clutch, back to the blues-driven hard rock sound that the band's debut had, and stuff that they would have probably done when they were Earth, which is kind of a cool to come full circle here. I haven't listened to any of Bill Ward's solo stuff, but if it's in this kind of style, if his vocals are cooking like this, I'm excited to check that out, because it really works for him here. They have John Elstar comes in, another session bloke. He plays the blues harp on this track, really driving home the fucking dirty blues. Cool closer, like I said, almost a tribute to their roots, and perhaps more in line with what Bill wanted to play, as opposed to Tony's more symphonic pop, wanting to be Brian May of Queen kind of vibes that he was doing. But the variety on this album fucking works for me. From back to front, it's kind of riff driven, like I said. The keys do kind of take over on Air Dance and parts of Johnny Blade, but it all fucking works. That's Never Say Die. Love it or hate it, I love it.
Far the riff compels me.
All right, now.
Let's talk about the studio here. Bringing us up to the Great White North, to the Sounds Interchange studio in Toronto, where the lads assembled to cut Never Say Die. That's right, Canadian connection for the Sabs. My birthplace, actually. Although I grew up on the West Coast in Vancouver, I was born in Toronto. It's funny, I never heard about the Sound Interchange while I was in Toronto, and I was kind of working in the music industry. It apparently shut down in the early 90s, but some cool artists recorded there. Must have been a good room, actually. Kiss did the fucking Elder there. Both Never Say Die and The Elder. Those are universally hated albums for two of the biggest rock bands. Metallica should have gone over there and done Saint Anger. That would have completed the trifecta. What else was done here? Here, I have a list in this article that I want to read. Let me find it. Yeah. Oh, cool. So, a lot of great Canadian content, hey? These names may not mean anything to you guys, but Tragically Hip, BTO, the Nylons, fucking Triumph. These are iconic Canadian rock acts from the 70s. And fuck, dude, Anne Murray. Of course she worked there. She cut There's a Hippo in My Tub at the Sound Interchange. Now, that's a fucking pedigree. In the same spot that Ozzy did lines off of some Zanzibar ladies, no doubt. Zanzibar is a big strip club in Toronto, if you don't know. Not that I frequented it or anything. But it's a fucking fun spot. It's done in a very campy kind of way. There's trapeze that the strippers go on. I won't lie, say I never went in for a pint. But sorry, this is all making me homesick. Shit. You know what? Looking at these names, what a fucking trip, man. This is like 6 degrees of separation from me here. So when I lived in Toronto, it wasn't that long ago, but I worked for a small record company called Sparks, doing their video content and such, and some A&R. And they were originally, back in the day, called Ready Records. So looking at the Sound Interchange's 80s output here from the studio, I know all these fucking artists from the Ready back catalog. You got the Spoons, Doug and the Slugs. So shit, they were all cutting albums in the same space back in the day. So I'm basically Ozzy's best friend by this connection, right? No, but it's just funny. I would have asked my boss if he ever crossed paths with Sabbath in the 70s if I knew this. Anyway, here's a cool article I found about the Sound Interchange Studio. A first-hand account of how Sabbath kind of came in and did their thing. This is from Ed Stone, who's one of the assistant engineers. He writes, I was lucky enough to have been one of the assistant engineers on the last Black Sabbath album with Ozzy and the band. The studio I worked in, called Sounds Interchange in downtown Toronto, was on quite a roll in 77 and 78. We had just had the Rolling Stones in to work on their Love You Live album, and as Ian Stewart, the Stones' road manager and sometimes keyboard player, said to me, you watch, Eddie. Every studio that the Stones go to, Black Sabbath follows shortly after. You'll see them in about 6 months. And he was right. I wonder what that connection is, actually. They might have the same producer sharing resources, creating crossover between the Stones and Sabbath. That's interesting. Back to Eddie's article here. The recording studio design market in the 70s was dominated by a gentleman called Tom Hindley, who designed our studio. And he made very nice sounding control rooms, but his recording rooms were heavily carpeted with lots of drapery, which created a rather dead sounding but beautifully appointed room in which the musicians had to play. Sabbath's producer and engineer said that it wasn't live enough. We needed to, so we moved the drums to another live area in the main room, also with slant floors and slanted wood ceiling, which faced out into the main carpeted area. This is where we would often record brass and wind instruments to give more of a live sound. We had a large wooden drum riser built. for Bill Ward's drum kit. And after a few days of sound checks, Sabbath did nothing in a hurry. Everything seemed satisfactory to the band and producer, and they were confident that this arrangement would provide proper room sound for the drums. I was one of the assistant engineers working with Sabbath on this album, and I had been working for several days in a row. It was decided to give our most junior assistant a chance to work with the band for the weekend, and I was given some time off. This young assistant editor had a penchant for, shall I say, some recreational pot smoking, as did various members of Sabbath's entourage. So when I arrived back in the studio early on Monday afternoon, I was not totally surprised to see the assistant come out of the control room into the lounge area where I was having a coffee with red-rimmed eyes looking frazzled beyond words. I said, "Hey, Dougie." Of course, his name's Dougie. We're in Canada, right? "Hey, Dougie. How was your weekend with the band, eh?" So see, I can do it because I'm Canadian. It's offensive if you guys do it. He just looked back at me miserably and motioned for me to follow him through the big, thick, double wooden doors that led into the studio. The drums were still on the riser that they had built in the live area of the studio, but now a huge 400-square-foot section of thick shag carpet that had covered the floor was missing and had been ripped up off the floor, leaving bits of carpet and glue everywhere. It looked utterly horrendous, creating a very different acoustic space. Very live, very spacious, but not at all like the studio designer had envisioned. After recovering from the shock of seeing what they had done to our world-class recording room, the senior engineer staff eventually decided to put in a parquet floor where the carpet had been ripped out. So Sabbath ended up getting the sound they needed, and they did end up paying for their spontaneous studio remodeling, as well as paying for the removal of all of Ozzy's signature penis drawings and Sharpie marker, which were all over the walls in the studio and control room. Still, Tony, Ozzy, Geezer, and Bill were hugely talented, but down-to-earth. Friendly guys that were a pleasure to work with and party with. Just don't leave them alone in your studio for too long. Okay, so that was a much longer article than I thought, but it's funny, it's good. Apparently, they would rehearse for the album in an old movie theater just down the street as well, which would have probably been torn down now. Anyway, next time I'm back in Toronto, I'm going to seek out all these Tech X, Never Say Die era sites. And so let's talk a bit about the touring for Never Say Die. But this is the last original caravan trip we'll be going on.
It is a funny story. I think those stories are kind of best in the caravan.
The touring schedule for Never Say Die, it's a full schedule, proper world tour. They bring along a hot young band, too, by the name of Van Halen. Now, I've never been a big fan of Van Halen. In fact, they represent a lot of what I hate about metal, that hair metal cheesiness, all that flashy pussy chasing shit. Yeah, sure, it's fun in small doses. It's fun to make fun of, really. But they're responsible for a whole movement of shitty guitarists. But Eddie's cool, don't get me wrong. There's no denying his talent. I just don't like the gimmicks, man. And that's all that people latch onto, the tapping solos and the fucking stupid dive bombs and all that shit. And hey, without glam metal, we wouldn't have the anti-glam, right? So the thrash and grunge movements, they wouldn't happen. So Van Halen's cool, I guess. Either way, everyone says that they blew Sabbath off the stage in 1978 and that they really showed that they were the new wave and Sabs were yesterday's news. And yeah, Sabbath were in a bad way during this tour, not getting along. So I'm sure Van Halen had more positive energy with Diamond Dave doing his jumps. Jump! Go ahead and jump! The crowd would more easily side with that garbage than the drugged up Ozzy in there droning his way through Paranoid for the thousandth time. But I take that over Panama, personally. Panama! Van Halen, man. I think there's a couple of Van Halen podcasts out there. Maybe I'll do a dive and see if I'm missing, if I'm just a little too surface with them. They had a great live album that my friend had. I had that. Fuck. I'll stop slamming Van Halen. I'm a big fan. So they start in the UK this time, in May, right through June. And something really special was captured at the last date of the UK swing that they did. They filmed a proper concert video, pro style, like full on edited with fucking star wipes and late 70s video transitions. We're all very lucky to have this final 70s tour concert film in glorious color. So after that gig, they take a break in July, and then they're over to the States for the big long haul, the last hurrah, as it becomes, which goes right through to December of 1978. Van Halen again staying with them, opening for them. Eventually, it becomes kind of a co-headlining with Van Halen. So, yeah, you really do see the rise of Van Halen. The last dates on the Never Say Die tour were December 10th and 11th. Back-to-back gigs in Albuquerque, New Mexico. I don't have the set list from those nights, but I did dig up one from December 7th in Abilene, Texas. So it would have been similar to this. The cool thing is they open with Superzar, played over the PA system. Classic Sabbath prelude. I love that comes into this time. And they launch in with the new opener, Symptom of the Universe. That'd be fucking killer. Could you imagine coming out of that Superzar? And then right into fucking... Sorry. Beavis and Butthead over here. So yeah, Symptom of the Universe, then into Snowblind, War Pigs, Never Say Die, Black Sabbath, Shockwave. That's fucking cool. Like, killer. I didn't know that made it into the live set. I love that track, man. So Shockwave, into Dirty Woman, Rock and Roll Doctor. So some Tech X love there, back-to-back tracks. Then you go into the drum and guitar solo. And then we get a great doomy run, Electric Funeral and Iron Man, back-to-back at last. And then the usual encore, the classic, Children of the Grave and Paranoid. Great fucking set, man. Just missing the NIB, maybe another Master of Reality track in there, like Into the Void or something. But at least there's something from every album. That's fucking cool. I'm really surprised by Shockwave being in there, that's all. So yeah, it was a big tour. God knows what happened. If the lads weren't getting along going into it, it probably just accelerated. And sadly, you know, and it led to the demise of this original Sabbath. So depending on who you talk to, Ozzy was either fired, asked to leave, or just quit. I mean, there's too many conflicting stories about his departure to give his definitive moment here on the show, but he'd already left once in 77, like we said, with plans to form his solo career. Ozzy wanted something fresh, and Tony wanted to plug on. And work had actually begun on what eventually turned out to be Heaven and Hell when Ozzy was still in the fold. So many interviewers talk about Ozzy not turning up for those rehearsals and not pulling his weight. So the work had begun, but the lineup was in fucking shambles. Geezer even said that Ozzy did a demo cut of Die Young and a skeletal version of Children of the Sea, Lady Evil, and even the next title track to come, Heaven and Hell. This was going to be their 10th anniversary, so they had plans to do an album for release in 1978, but it all fell apart again. And so, April 27th, 1979, Ozzy went solo. And our man Dio didn't come on board until March of 79, so sometime in early 79 is most likely when Ozzy was fired slash quit slash whatever. So damn, man, that was it for Sabbath in the 70s. Okay, so now I'm really getting a little emotional here. It's been a fun dive back into these albums. But that's Never Say Die. So thanks again to everyone who checked out the show this year. It's been a fucking blast. A big thank you to Metal Up Your Podcast, Clinton, Ethan, Tom at Alpha Metallica, Metalla Chat, Metalla Cast, Metalla everything. I love this community, man. But more people need to get podding. I want to see some Priest pods. I want to see a fucking Motorhead, Slayer, fucking GNR, Megadeth, Pantera. Why has no one done a fucking Pantera podcast yet? Come on, lads. Metallica's covered. Let's move on. If you're thinking about doing it, give it a shot. It doesn't have to be an every week deal like the big dogs do. Just work your way through your favorite artists like I do. Trust me, it's fucking rewarding. You'll find some new favorites, some hidden treasures. It's fun. Do it casually, man. Like, people will listen. I'll support you. So as I take a few months chilling out here, school's out for summer. Let's go to the lake, girls. Let's get some margaritas in. Keep on, bog blast all of you.